You're listening to 101.5 FM The Hawk out of Hamilton, Ontario. Tonight, I'm joined by Canadian musician, songwriter, and record producer Aaron Goldstein. You just heard the song Tricks of the Heart off of Aaron's self-titled release, Espanola. Aaron, so you released this album last year, and the songs on Espanola were partly recorded in Saskatchewan back in 2014, and the rest were recorded in Toronto between 2016 and 2019. So these songs are a labor of love, and the rock and roll sound is a bit of a departure from some of the alt country or folk music you're known to play. So I guess my first question is, how did you find time to complete it, given your crazy schedule, and what made you complete it finally?
Okay, it's an interesting question. I guess, for years I had been traveling and playing with other people, and trying to fit in my own thing, like, in between. I mean, you know, part of the reason I started the record in Saskatchewan all those years ago was that I had been in that studio the previous year playing on a Zachary Lucky record, and I loved the place. This guy Chad Mason ran it. He's still out there, but he built a new place. And that was sort of part of the reason that I made a mental note next time I was near Saskatoon, I should try and book some dates with Chad at his place. But then in terms of finding the time to complete it, it was really that I had opened Baldwin Street. And even though, I mean, I'm thankfully so busy there, and I'm making a lot of records for other people, but once in a while there's a little bit of a breather, or, you know, the whole music industry is kind of peaks and valleys. And so sometimes I find myself with the odd day, and I just sort of told myself, well, now that I own this studio, this, you know, it had been the dream for so long. I should really try and make the time to finish this record of mine that I've been working on. But really the thing that made me finish it in a hurry was, you know, I was sitting with it like 75 or 80% complete for so long. And I went through the type of things that I watch all my clients go through with their own records, which is that I would put it on some days and love it. And some days I would be like, what am I doing? This is awful. but I started playing again with Ian Blurton, who I had played with years ago. And he's, you know, a well-known record producer and a guitar player. And he had produced a record for my old band Huron, who, you know, frankly, I know we're in Hamilton now, and, you know, Hamilton is like the only town where anybody really kind of remembers Huron. Anyway, Ian had produced the Huron record, and I got into his new band called Future Now. He asked me to come be the second guitar player, and we were going out to travel across Canada and do a little tour for the first Future Now record. And Ian pitched an idea to me where he said, why don't you finish your record, and the four of us will go out and we'll play one set of yours and one set of mine. Cool. Which was awesome and a very generous offer of him to make. And so it really kind of made me, like, it kind of put me in gear to, you know, to finish this record. And I'm so glad I did, because it was sitting around and it was almost done in so many ways. And really all I needed was a couple of overdubs and, some mixes and stuff like that. Although I should say Tricks of the Heart was really late in the game. Like, I wrote that at the very end, and I was like, oh, great. This is like the last piece of the puzzle for this record.
And so how many of the instruments on the album did you play? Like, was it all kind of pre-recorded by you, or did other folks join you?
Over the course of the record, I play all the different instruments. However, there are lots of other people on the record. When I went to Saskatchewan, it was actually in the town of Delisle, which is just this tiny little – I was actually never in the town. I was only at Chad Mason's studio, which is outside of Delisle. But when I went out there – and this is, again, 2014. Part of it was me trying to say, like, you know, I don't want to make this record in the heart of Toronto. I have so many friends and acquaintances and peers in Toronto whom I love and respect. It would almost be, like, too much for me to decide who should play on the record. And I had to be in Saskatchewan for something else anyway. So I called my friend Luke Getz, who used to play with the Deep Dark Woods for years. He was the drummer. And Ryan Gullen, who is still actually with the Sheepdogs. So Luke and Ryan played drums and bass respectively. And there's, I think, five songs that survived from that session that made it to the record. I think we cut like eight or so, and I ended up keeping you know, over the years, one or two of them just kind of fell by the wayside. I chose the wrong tempo or whatever. But so they're on a good portion of the record, Ryan and Luke. And then I brought the sessions back to Hamilton. I was already in Toronto by then, but I cut a keyboard session in Hamilton at Boxcar, and Ben Summer engineered it. Dan Edmonds played a bunch of the keyboards. He's a local Hamilton pal, and then has made some great records himself. And then there were later sessions where there were some tunes that I went and sat down to do myself, and I played all the drums and the bass and whatever. And some of those didn't make the cut, and I recut them with like Len Milcham is on a track, and Jake Boyd is on a track, and Rich Knox. Those three guys are all drummers, and they each have a track on the record. But a couple of them, like a couple of my demos that I made by myself, they ended up on the record. So there's at least two, I think, where I'm the drummer and the bass player. And I play virtually all the guitars and the pedal steel. And then the keys are sort of a mix. Anthony Carone is on a track. Dan Edmonds is on a lot of them. It was really just like a piecemeal kind of.
Do you have a favorite song on the album?
I don't know. That's kind of hard to pick. I like Living Room Blues a lot because I was really happy when I wrote it, and I felt like it was kind of an accomplished composition. But I kind of feel the same way about Outside Saskatoon, which is like more of a basic and kind of dumb song. But I really was happy that I could pull something off that I thought was a cool little story song and that felt kind of effortless. But I don't know. I have different times with, you know, it's kind of how I feel about the Huron record too. There's times when I don't even really want to put it on at all. But once in a while, if I hear it, like if my kid is listening to it or something.
Let's listen to a song. Pick one of those two, and we'll listen to that. And then we'll come back and we'll chat a little bit more, okay?
Yeah, okay. I think Living Room Blues is a good call, especially coming from Tricks of the Heart. It's more the ballad of the record.
This is Aaron Goldstein and his band Espanola. You're listening to 101.5 FM The Hawk, and this is Living Room Blues.
Badgering, if we do, it'd be a damn disgrace.
Tuning in, you're listening to 101.5 FM The Hawk out of Hamilton, Ontario. That was Living Room Blues by Espinola. Tonight, my guest is Canadian musician Aaron Goldstein, and that was his song. So Aaron Goldstein is known for his pedal steel guitar playing and playing on records with such bands as City in Color, Kathleen Edwards, you know, a bunch of thousands of people. So Aaron's also the owner of the music studio Baldwin Street Sound. So Baldwin Street Sound is a boutique analog and digital recording studio in the heart of downtown Toronto. And Aaron Goldstein produces from there, and it's his kind of like home base of operations. Aaron, the studio itself and the building has such a fascinating story. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, for sure. It's very vibey in there, and it's been a lot of different things. So it's in a neighborhood called Baldwin Village, which is east of Spadina. It's kind of across Spadina Avenue from Kensington Market, which a lot of people know. And it's a little stretch of this otherwise kind of small street that it's sort of one block worth, where there's a bunch of restaurants and used to be a famous old bakery there. And it's really just kind of a little, sometimes I think of it as a little slice of Brooklyn right in the heart of Toronto. And it really is right in the core. It's between, all the hospitals and the universities, and it's right by the art gallery, and it's right by Kensington. The building itself was built in 1918, and it was the original Silverstein's Bakery. And then years later, they built a huge facility right just over the road on McCall Street that became a big industrial bakery supplier. But this was the original Silverstein's, and it was a bakery for years. And I have the back of the building, so the front is still a retail store, and I occupy the rear of the building. But in my unit where I have the studio now, there was a huge bagel oven, like a bread and bagel oven that was made out of brick, and it was floor to ceiling, and it was apparently the secondary oven because the bakery got so busy in the front. And so they built this second oven. Originally, I understand it was built in the backyard of the original building, and then they built an extension around it, which is now my live room, which is where I record all the bands. And it was actually still there when I first acquired the space, and I eventually had to take the oven out of there. It wasn't serviceable anymore. Like, it couldn't be anything other than a big pile of bricks. So it had to go, but it was pretty cool. But then after the bakery moved out, and after they moved to their big industrial facility, a lot of the block that I'm on was sort of friendly to draft dodgers. During the Vietnam War, people would dodge the draft, and they'd come up, and there was a store in the front of my address called the Yellow Ford Truck, and it was named after, I guess, this group of hippies had this yellow van, and they would drive to Buffalo and pick up people who were trying to dodge the draft and bring them back. And yeah, and they all flopped, not just at my address, but I think all through the block. And it was a really popular spot for people to come up and try and start again in Canada who didn't want to go to war. And there were a whole bunch of stores on the street that were run by this collective of sort of hippies. It was a little bit, it was more the early 70s than it was the late 60s, I think, but they were still definitely hippies. And in fact, I have a photograph of a street festival taking place right outside of my address on Baldwin Street in the summer of 1970 with big stacks of old Trainer amps and a band playing in the street.
Cool.
Yeah, it's awesome. And then afterwards, I think it had a couple different incarnations over the years that I'm a little unclear on, but it was essentially a speakeasy for some number of years. And in fact, one of the proprietors of the speakeasy still lives upstairs. my understanding is that, I don't know, when I was first acquiring the space, they told me Aykroyd and Belushi partied in here and every hockey player was in here. And one of the old proprietors, she's still around and she's kind of a pal because she's in the neighborhood. And she walked in the studio and said, I stood right there and served a drink to Leonard Cohen.
Oh.
Yeah. Well,
and so for those just joining us, we're speaking with Aaron Goldstein, who's talking about his studio, Baldwin Street Sound, based out of Toronto. Aaron's a pedal steel guitar player, producer, musician. And so speaking of these, of the legend of your own studio, are there studios that you are inspired by or you find legendary? And are there some that you've been to and some that you still want to go to?
Yeah, absolutely. There's this book that I've been meaning to read that I have never read, but it's been recommended to me. It's called Temples of Sound, and it's sort of a catalog of just cool studios. And it's funny the different shapes that a recording studio can take, because certainly over the years the technology has changed and that has informed how, you know, the shape that different places take and the type of investment that's necessary for them and all that stuff. And, you know, we all know about like Motown and how the hits got made in this, essentially this little room where, you know, they had spent some bucks on some decent equipment, but it was really like kind of a small space. I've still actually never visited there and I'd love to check it out.
I've been to, they're doing a big extension there now.
Oh yeah. And like turning it into a museum. Well, I guess it's already kind of a museum, right?
Yeah. And then I guess the legend story there is that, you know, they recorded a lot of the songs in the bathroom because of the vocal acoustics, right?
Oh, hilarious. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I've been down to Stax, which is no longer a functioning studio, but I can see why that was a totally worthy place, you know, to record something. They say like a lot of places that go into a space that's already built, they tend to look for floors that are not perfectly even because they don't like the parallel surfaces. So it's like really common to find like old mechanics garages turned into studios because the floors are sloped towards the drain. And Stax had been a theater, like a movie theater where the floor is sloped. And you know what? The floor in my place, I mean, you've been there. It's not perfectly straight. There's something about it that is a little bit cockeyed. And I think that actually really makes the room sound good. I love working at the bathhouse. It's been a while since I've been there, but that's the Hips place that's out near Kingston. Mm-hmm. And that place is super special and the gear is amazing.
Well, Jeff Tweedy's son, Spencer Tweedy, he's coming out with a book later. I think it's later this month. And it's about, I think it's called Mirror Sound. And it's about, it's kind of about home recording and people cool. that make like spaces and great albums out of their own kind of home spaces.
Yeah.
And so how did you go about kind of like accumulating all of your gear? Like where was it before? And I guess I'm going to ask you two questions at once, which you're never supposed to do, I guess, technically, but I'm still learning. like, do you have like a studio mentor that you run questions by? So, you know, like you compile all this stuff, like before you took that huge step in making your own studio, like, did you have someone that you could ask questions to, or did you just figure it out as you went?
Interesting. I've mostly figured it out as I've gone, and that's for better or for worse. I wouldn't always say that was the right way to go, but definitely I've just sort of osmosed the right way to do it. And I've, you know, I've definitely, there's been missteps for sure. I have a couple of people that I talk to about gear. I guess the chief guy, and I think that this guy is this person for a lot of people. And that's Colin Cripps, who is, of course, a native Hamiltonian, guitarist in Blue Rodeo and formerly of Crash Vegas and Junkhouse. And I met Colin through Tom Wilson. I mean, I've worked for Tom Wilson and played in his band for over 10 years. And I would have met Colin through him because they're old friends. And Colin is really like a guru when it comes to equipment and, you know, particularly like collectible stuff. He's been at it for years since, you know, before the internet, certainly. And, you know, before there was really a real strong market. I mean, he was at it when he was a kid. And actually, funny enough, Colin's childhood friend was Dan Aiken, who was the founder and owner of Catherine North Studios in Hamilton, like another beautiful and amazing studio. And Dan and Colin together acquired a lot of equipment over the years. And Colin is still a guy who I will, you know, I'll run some things by him before I buy anything, because I always want to know his opinion. I also know that I'm operating in a different climate than he was when he started. And, you know, the really good stuff is so expensive now that it's kind of impossible to acquire if you're a working musician. But there is other great stuff. You know, I would say that most of my collection of equipment is what you'd call player grade. So it's not collector grade, but it's definitely good stuff that has been played and is maybe knocked around a bit, but definitely has the mojo.
Sorry to interrupt you there, but I'm curious. So for those just joining, we're talking to Aaron Goldstein of Baldwin Street Sound, also pedal steel guitarist extraordinaire. So we were just talking about you know, the creation of a studio, the mentorship involved. What's the upkeep like on all the instruments within your studio? Like, I kind of look at it like a, you know, if you look at your instruments like a sports team, and like, you know, some people got to stretch, some people got to get rehabbed. Like, how do you take care of everything and make sure that it's up to par?
I mean, I'm kind of an obsessive and I kind of just make sure that, well, first of all, any old amplifier, and like basic, you know, my main weakness is old amplifiers, and I have a lot of them. And, I don't even know the number, but I mean, it's not crazy. There are definitely collectors out there. I'm not Joe Bonamassa over here, but in terms of like a small, you know, sole proprietorship studio, I have a pretty good collection of vintage amps, and really I don't have anything really redundant. I have a lot of different flavors, and that's what I love. Like, I love, you know, if I have a real strength in terms of producing records, I'm kind of a guitar tone guy. And so I really want to make sure that things get done right. But anyway, anytime a new old amp comes into my possession, it usually needs capacitors, which is like a power supply thing. And sometimes it needs speakers, and it just generally needs maintenance. And so I have a couple of different people who will do that kind of maintenance for me. And then there's more than 20 guitars in the studio, and those always need something. And again, my assistant, who's great, has worked on some guitars for me. And then I have a couple of buddies who are actually touring technicians, you know, who go out on the road and they work on guitars for guys. And if one of those guys is home with his tech box, sometimes I can coax them into come in and do some work on a bunch of guitars at once. But it's ongoing. It's something that I have to be committed to, because I want my tools to work, you know.
So for those just joining us, we're talking to Aaron Goldstein from Baldwin Street Sound. And I guess I just want to talk about touching on that point, knowing about your collection of amps that you have, guitars that you have. When a new band comes into the studio to work with you, you know how, like, you know, maybe a metaphor to compare it to would be like, you know, pairing a fine wine with a nice dinner. Like, do you pair up the artist with the equipment in your collection? Like, are you like, oh, that person is this or that? Or like, do you have that foresight in mind, or do you figure it out as you go, or do you, like, just don't touch my stuff?
No. All the stuff is there to be used when people come in to make records, for sure. It's all like available. Okay. I usually have a pretty good idea when they're on their way in, because anybody coming in to work with me, I've already heard the demos. And so I have an idea of like how I want it to sound. And I also hopefully have something of an idea of the type of equipment they might play on stage. But also, like, let me say this too, you know, for the number of amps that I've got and the number of guitars and all the different things that I've got, I'm a huge proponent of you learn how to work what you've got, and you learn how to do your absolute best with what's there, because it's a bottomless hole to go and keep acquiring more and more equipment. And, you know, that stuff doesn't make better records necessarily. I really, like, if I'm anything, I'm a song guy, which is why I want the demos first. No amp or guitar is going to write a great song, you know? And my process, although I do really commit to getting good sounds and I want to get great sounds, my process is really more about getting the band in there and workshopping the songs until they're right. And that's kind of, I don't really do any pre-production or anything like that. I get them in, we get sounds, we get going, and then we workshop the songs while we're cutting them. And we keep making changes, like keep taking the sandpaper to them until there's a finished thing, until there's a finished arrangement, and then we cut what we've got. And yes, in the process, if somebody's guitar doesn't sound right, I'll swap out an amp, I'll swap out a mic on an amp, I'll go and tweak the amps. Like, that's a thing for sure. But also, I should say, a lot of your tone is in your hands, and that's kind of an old like saying that a lot of guitar players roll their eyes at, but I really believe that, you know, people who have a really distinctive guitar tone, like Ian Blurton, my old pal, my aforementioned pal, I know that no matter what he plugs into, I will know that it's him playing, because it's so distinctive the way he plays.
Well, and I've been privy to your process, and mm-hmm. and I have to just pay you a huge compliment in that, you know, I've been in the studio with bands as you work with them, and you really have a knack, I have to say, about just kind of guiding people without them even realizing they're being guided, but bringing out the best in them. And
well,
I think it's a craft, and I think that you're excellent at it.
Thank you. It's an art. I mean, it's a lot of things. It's like a psychological job a little bit. Not that I'm trying to like get the better of anybody, but really
to get the best.
Right. Well, for sure. I definitely want to get the best out of them. But the way I think of it is my responsibility is to the material, even though, you know, it's the band or the label that is actually paying my invoice. My responsibility is to the material and making the material the absolute, you know, putting it in its best clothes or something mm-hmm. like that. And if I, you know, whatever method I need to use to get there, that's on me. I got to do it.
So for those just joining us, we're talking to Aaron Goldstein, and Aaron Goldstein is a producer, a songwriter. And we're talking about the process of studio work. And so I guess I'm going to shift gears a little bit now with questions.
Sure.
And so I've known you now for, I think, about 20 years.
Yeah, a long time, Mary.
And I've known you
back.
Since you were a little kid standing outside of out of the horseshoe. And so basically, you're now a father. And you know, your son, who's now in senior kindergarten, he's becoming one of the biggest music fans that I've ever seen. And so what's your favorite part of watching him learn music, and how do you share music with him?
Interesting question. Okay, so before he was born, I decided, like, you know, my kid should get into music the same way I did. And I was lucky. This weird thing happened to me where even though I was born in the 1980s, I really only listened to, like, Fats Domino and Little Richard and like really old stuff when I was young. I think my parents were just really into the oldies station, and I wasn't really made aware of anything else. I got way, way into Buddy Holly, who of course died like in 1959. And I just like listened to all this old stuff, and then I discovered the Beatles. So it was like I understood all the groundwork that came before the Beatles.
Right.
You know, in the way that people might have understood in 1963 or four when they first heard the Beatles, which is weird that that happened to me, but I feel so lucky that that happened to me in that way. So I kind of decided I'm going to make this mix for Michelle, my wife, to play in her car while she was still pregnant. And I basically just put on Fats Domino and Little Richard and like all the old, you know, tons of Chuck Berry and all that old stuff that like really informed me that to me is really like the absolute essential building blocks of everything that like rhythmically is so basic to the understanding of, well, and you know, also melodically. And also if you think about Chuck Berry, like lyrically and all that stuff.
You should call it the Get a Womb Mix.
Nice. I called it Baby G's First Mix before he even had a name, of course. He wasn't born yet. And from there, like, I don't know. I just try and share with him things that I think would be good. Like, he's been listening to the Beatles since he was really, really young. Way younger than I can remember being into the
Beatles. Who's his favorite Beatle and who's yours?
Interesting. So mine's George for sure. And I don't know if his is George or Ringo. But I think he kind of likes them all differently and at, you know, at different times. He also knows about Pete Best because he once was looking at this picture of the four Beatles in Hamburg with Pete Best on drums, and I made this offhand comment to him that Pete Best was a footnote, and it was a thing that he went around repeating like forever. Pete Best is a footnote. Eli, who's Pete Best? He's a footnote. Which is kind of unfair to Pete Best, but I thought that was really funny. And he, you know, he kind of knows a lot of the catalog, like not all of it, but he's excited to hear Beatles songs that he's never heard before. And doesn't even bother me that he's kind of singularly obsessed with them right now, because the catalog is so vast. And I know that like how many times I've come back to the catalog and known that it has like delivered to me again and again. And also I found myself kind of weirdly getting emotional when I would play things for him that I hadn't heard myself in a long time. Whenever I play stuff for him, it's almost like I hear it again for the first time. Like I'm hearing it through his ears, and that it really kind of weirdly, I mean, maybe this is just fatherhood, but it really like touches me to hear, like, for example, just before Tom Petty died, for some reason I put on You Don't Know How It Feels for him. And I hadn't heard that song in like, I don't know, 15 years or something, and I had this kind of emotional reaction to it, to how good that song is, and to how excited he must be to hear it for the first time, because it really is like one of the all-time great songs, you know. It's a really interesting trip, like being such a, you know, the reason that I do this is because I'm just a massive insatiable music fan myself, and I had to do it myself in order to like satisfy myself. And so to sort of hear music again for the first time by introducing it to him is this really like wild trip for me.
That's incredible. Yeah. For those just joining us, we're talking to Aaron Goldstein on 101.5 FM The Hawk. Aaron's a pedal steel player, producer, musician, incredible songwriter. Aaron, do you have a favorite record of all time, or does it change depending on your age?
Definitely changes, but I have some that I think I'll never, ever put down. Like the Brown album, the band, of course. After the Gold Rush, you know, the Neil Young record. Records that, like, I can never see myself wanting to be without. Records that are so, so important to me. And then there's others that have really, like, that I, you know, that I'm really into for different reasons. Like, you know, the Ray Charles Country and Western records, those are unbelievable. I think Ray Charles was pretty much the best vocalist to ever live. Actually, several of his records are very important to me. And then, you know, years later, I got into country music, like way into country music. And that genre is less about LP records. It's more about singles, right? But I still have like tons of country LPs that I really love.
Did you not meet Kenny Rogers when you were playing?
I did.
Danny Ramone?
I did. It was at Bonnaroo. Dan and I were both playing and sitting in color at the time. And yeah, Kenny Rogers was on our stage. I mean, he was a few acts afterwards. Kathleen Edwards was on that day as well. And yeah, I don't know. We were just in the same backstage. And I'm not the guy that asks for pictures. But I just saw him and I was like, how can I not get a picture with Kenny Rogers?
And so speaking of Kathleen Edwards, you just recently played, was it her record release show?
I did. I played on her new record. And I've been sort of subbing with her, like just sort of sneaking into her band here and there to cover for other guys for about 10 years now. I mean, off and on, pretty sporadically, but the past couple of summers when she was sort of not really busy and she was still kind of in her hibernation or whatever, she took some jobs, just duo stuff, and I went out with her and did some duo and also some trio stuff with her, which was a lot of fun. She, like, I'll tell you this story. I don't know if I've ever actually told her this, but when I first got my first pedal steel, I turned to Michelle, who's now my wife, and I made a comment that was kind of like, you know, this is a really niche thing, and if I ever get good enough, I could maybe even play with someone like Kathleen Edwards, because I was really into her first record, and she was so, like, distant in my mind, you know? Like, she wasn't somebody that I could, like, know or play with, you know? But,
And what's your favorite song that you played, at the release? This was, what was it, like 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, it was like 3 weeks ago. Yeah. I think my favorite on that new record is called Simple Math. I really love that new record. I'm lucky that Kathleen is like kind of my friend now, and certainly, you know, I've been lucky enough to, you know, to play a bit with her, but I'm really still such a fan, and I think this new record like really fits so perfectly in her catalog and is so worthy of her catalog. And I really love that song, Simple Math.
That's incredible. Well, let's listen to a Kathleen Edwards song right now, and then we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more about some other music. Okay?
Right on.
A kite just bobbing like a breeze and a change in the wind. That's just the way it is. Numbers never were my strength, and I barely got a passing grade. You teach me that love is simple math. I don't care. I'm just one and you're one and we're two together. I'm okay being friends forever. You and I were only eight, growing up on the same street. Like a breeze and a change in the wind. Oh, and you're just a kid. But everything and nothing changes. And now your girls are the same age. You teach me. And you're one and we're two together. now we are our mother's age. And love is simple math. I don't care how old we get. I'm just one and you're one and we're two together. I'm okay being friends forever. Oh, love is simple math. And I can be a total pain in the ass. But I'm just one and you're one and we're two together. I'm okay being friends forever.
You're listening to 101.5 FM The Hawk. I'm joined tonight with Aaron Goldstein. Aaron Goldstein is a pedal steel guitar player from such bands as Dan Romano, City in Color, Kathleen Edwards, Bri Webb and the Providers. A-Gold, as I call you. So you're Toronto born and bred. What was the first Toronto music venue that you played, like, in your own band, and you were like, wow?
Interesting question. I don't know. Oh, well, okay, I do know. I must have been in grade 8 or 9. I never really, like, all my friends were doing those battles of the bands, like Supernova and all that stuff, and I never actually did any of those. Like, I think we all knew they were scams anyway, but I really was sort of opposed to it. And also, when I was in high school, I didn't really, like, I played music and I kind of was in a couple of bands, but never anything that was even serious enough to play one of those battles of the bands until I think I was in grade 12 and we played at the Cathedral, which was the main floor of the Big Bop, the corner of Bathurst and Queen, right? The Cathedral was the main floor, Cathedral with a K. And then the Reverb was upstairs, the Reverb room. And then the third floor was Holy Joe's. And that I spent a lot of time in that building, actually, seeing bands and, yeah, playing there. I mean, the show was a complete disaster. Like, we were still underage. We had to rent the room to put on the show. I think we owed them $600 or something like that.
What about Holy Joe's? Holy cow.
Yeah, right? All the way up there.
Yeah.
I saw a couple shows there. I'm pretty sure that's the first place that I played in my own band. And it was the kind of band where, like, I played drums for a few songs and then guitar for a few songs. I mean, I think there might even be some video footage out there now, but it was a complete disaster. But I was so young, and I definitely, you know, it sort of helped me cut my teeth a little bit. I definitely remember, in terms of, like, seeing bands, I remember walking into the Alma Combo downstairs when I probably wasn't even of age. And this band called the 68s were playing, and they became Zeus, or parts thereof became Zeus. I didn't know at the time, but I bought their CD, their, like, homemade CDR. And I have pretty vivid memories of, like, hanging out downstairs at the Alma Combo and in the Silver Dollar and in the Free Times and stuff before I was of age, where I kind of just, like, walked in sheepishly and nobody said anything.
It's like how I met you.
Yeah, exactly. Also, it was a big deal to play the Horseshoe for the first time, which is, like, I actually don't remember what band it was, but it was years ago. Might have been the Achievers, which was this band I had before Huron. That was always, like, a huge milestone.
So do you remember, when was the first time that you played the States, and when was the first time that you played overseas?
Oh, interesting. Okay. The first time I played in the States was with Tom Wilson, for sure. So I've been, since Tom has been making these Lee Harvey Osmond records, and now there are, I believe, 4 of them. We just won a Juno for the last one. I've been playing on those records, and they've all been produced by Michael Timmins of the Cowboy Junkies. And Tom kind of had this affiliation with the Cowboy Junkies where he would open their shows for quite a while. And he's still on their label. And actually, their label, which is called Latent Recordings, they put out the Huron record, my old rock band, Huron. So the first show in the States was me and Tom as a duo opening for the Cowboy Junkies. It was in a town in Pennsylvania. I forget the name, but I know that it was at this theater that they called the Blob Theater because it was the theater where they filmed the movie The Blob. And I remember we drove all day, like it was a good 9 hours. We drove all day to get there. Mm-hmm. Got there in time to like play our set, played an amazing set. All of those shows were always really good because Tom is such a showman that he just captivates the entire room. And we played our set and we were starving and we went across the road and this little Italian restaurant was about to close up, but we got them to let us in and we had a plate of spaghetti just because we were so starving and so exhausted. Yeah.
And then overseas, what was that?
Overseas, I'm trying to remember what the first show was.
A lot of different bands like Elliot Brew, Danny Romano. Like...
Yeah. I think my first overseas tour was with City in Color. I'm pretty sure. And I have to be honest, I don't remember what the first night was, but I do think that we did mainland Europe first and then went over to England. Because I remember finishing in London at the Roundhouse. I'm not sure what the first night was. It might have been Amsterdam or somewhere in Belgium or something like that. So I guess it wasn't as memorable as... But I mean, I have a lot of great memories of playing in Europe. I love playing over there. In fact, I was scheduled to bring Espanola over there in October. And because of COVID, it's postponed. So I'm going next year.
And Aaron, if you could chart your perfect tour, no matter what the budget was, no matter what the expenses were, and if you had like, and maybe this is a question to think about, but like if you had, 12 dates to do, no matter where or when it was,
yeah,
give a couple of the venues and places that you would like to go.
Yeah, of course. It would be in Europe without a doubt. Mm-hmm. Because Europe is just so...
But you could go to North America and Europe.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Imagination.
Well, geez, I don't know. I mean... It's funny. I've said this to people before. You know, there are some cities that I love that I haven't necessarily had great shows in, and then other cities where I've had these great shows that has colored my opinion of that city so much. Like, I always had great shows in Cincinnati for some reason, but I don't really know much about Cincinnati other than they have Mike's Music, which is this great store with vintage guitars, you know? So, like, if I was to wake up on a bus, like, behind that theater next to Mike's Music and got to go shopping Mike's all day and then got to play that night. Like that's a great day for me, you know, but also like, I love being in Hamburg. I mean, look, there's no substitute for Amsterdam. Amsterdam is like, well, and also I have to say Groningen, which is this town that's like 2.5 hours from Amsterdam. I think, okay, that's an all timer for me is Vera. Vera is the name of the venue. It's in Groningen and, over there they call it Groningen, mm-hmm. like with a H sound. Start and end the tour in Groningen.
There is
sure.
Also a good Pink Floyd song that actually Luther Wright and the Wrongs do an incredible cover of, eh?
Yeah, what? Called Groningen?
No, Vera.
Oh, Vera. No, okay. I was like, I haven't heard that Pink Floyd song. Yeah, Vera is...
Again?
Mary, you would love this place if you ever get over there. Like, it is... I mean, you know, you've scoped out some awesome venues before, and mm-hmm. it's not that there's anything particularly, like, amazing about Vera. It's just perfect. It's just so perfect for what it is. And it's an amazing town. It's kind of like a university town that's like a mini Amsterdam. Yeah, I love it there. But I also loved playing in Spain a lot, which is like, it's not particularly close. It's like a good day and a half drive from there. But I love playing in Madrid and Barcelona. Those are always great.
Have
in
you
the
ever
States,
played
like,
Primavera Sound, that festival? I've heard so much about it.
Wait, the festival where? Sorry. Oh. Primavera. No, I don't think I ever did it. That's in Barcelona, right?
Yeah, I think so.
No, I've only ever done this place in Barcelona called Sala Rock Sound.
Okay.
But I've done it like 3 or 4 times, and it's just a tiny bar, but it's awesome. The thing about Spain that's funny is like, if the show's scheduled for 9 o'clock, you'll be in there at 8:56, and there'll be nobody in there. and you'll be like, nobody's coming to this show. And then at 8:57, they all come walking down the street together.
What are your thoughts about, like, all my American friends, when they come to Toronto, and they're like, we go on at midnight? And they're like, yeah. What? Like,
yeah, I hate that.
Like, do you find, is that an adjustment when you travel to different cities? How does the time start influence, like, the day before, you know, the day that leads up to it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've done a little bit of bus touring, and most of my touring has been in vans, which of course, like, really influences how you feel about your start time. If I could start at midnight for a crowd that was expecting me at midnight and was ready to have a good time at midnight, mm-hmm. and then I got to get in my bunk at 1:45 or whatever, and then not worry about the drive at all, then I wouldn't care if that's what was going on. And I would happily, like, adjust my, you know, my internal clock for a few weeks on the road, but that's usually not how it is. Usually, like, you're in a hotel, you got to wake up and drive. Even if you're not the one driving, you got to sit in a van for a while. And midnight is lousy. I don't want to go on at midnight ever. But it comes down to, you know, when you're like, where's the best place to play or what's the best time to play? It's really like whatever is going on in that town, whatever space those people want to see the show and whatever time they expect to see it is when you have to be ready to play.
Right.
Because that's what you're there for. You're there to, like, give people a good time. And I just, you know, when I get to do theater tours and I get to go on at 9 o'clock, like, that's perfect, you know, to be able to play at, like, a civilized hour.
And for those just joining us, we're talking to Aaron Goldstein, who's a pedal steel guitar player, record producer, singer, songwriter. Aaron, do you prefer playing for soft seaters? Do you prefer playing for stand-up crowds? Like, do you have a preference, or does it just depend on the band that you're playing with?
Really depends who I'm with. I love doing Massey, and I love doing all of those similar soft seat rooms. Like, that's beautiful, especially with somebody like Bri. Shout out to Bri.
Massey Hall. You've played there a bunch, right?
Yeah, I've gotten to do Massey, like, might be 6 or 7 times at this point.
And what's your favorite song and favorite performance? Can you think of it that you have?
Interesting. Okay, so there's a very memorable moment during my set with Bri, where I broke a string on stage at Massey. And it was leading into a song in his set called Rivers of Gold, which is from his first record, which I didn't play on that record. Mike Brooks is the pedal steel player on that record. But in the show, me and Rich Burnett, who's the lap steel player, the whole tune is just Bri and the two steel players.
Mm-hmm.
So I had broken a string at the very end of the previous song. So instead of making my contribution to this next song, I looked over at Rich and he gave me the nod that he could handle it. And during this very, like, low key and quiet song, I spent the entire song with a string winder in my hand, just frantically winding the string to get it on for the next tune. So that's definitely my most memorable onstage Massey moment. And I wasn't even playing. I was frantically trying to get ready for the next tune. I think I got it on there in time to play, like, the last coda of the song, just the last little outro. But also I have a really fond memory of walking on the stage there for the first time to soundcheck, the first time I ever played there, and getting kind of choked up because it's very kind of emotional. You know, it's a legendary place. I saw so many shows there as a kid. It's this thing that when you grow up in Toronto, you, like, aspire to get there. It's this real milestone. And some people have great careers and never get there. And so to be able to walk out there for the first time was pretty amazing.
Well, that's incredible. So, Eagle, we're coming up on time here, but I just wanted to say thank you so much.
My pleasure, Mary.
For joining tonight. And for those that were listening, that was Aaron Goldstein, Baldwin Street Sound proprietor and genius and musician and singer-songwriter and just all-around great friend in person. So thank you so much.
My pleasure, Mary. Thank you for asking me. Great to talk to you.
Great talk to you. Have a good night, my dear.
You too.
Bye.
See you later.
You're listening to The Hawk 101.5 FM in Hamilton, Ontario.
What? Why you acting so wishy-washy? Empty in my pockets like a washing machine. Stop telling yourself to run back to me, cause we both know this a nightmare, not a dream. You acting real wishy-washy, cleaning out my pockets like a washing machine. Stop telling yourself to run back to me, cause we both know this a nightmare, not a dream. I know you gon' disappear. You probably didn't want me. Like Lauren and the Fugees, you be killing softly. So many times you tell me that you're really sorry, but all I really hear is that you're wishy-washy. Whoa,
wishy-washy. Whoa, wishy-washy.
Whoa,
wishy-washy.
Every time you say you are gonna come back, you left me with a negative impact. Car, from me a walking trophy, me a boss, me a don, you don't know me. Mighty gal, you real and show me. Dirty boy, you more than owe me.
You don't even really care,
you're leaving it up in the air. And even though it's hard to bear, I know that you don't really.
I'm about to go, so you should probably buy a photo. I'm out the door, but yo, you got me by the hormones. I doubt you're feeling shit or worry that I hold, though. Know that down the river where you surely finna row, row. You silly poppy, always a wishy-washy. Bad as a diddy top me, harder than a tsunami. Still, I dare you to rob me. Queen of kings like I'm Rodney. Creed a ting and you salty. You gon' win every loss, B.
I know you gon' disappear. Cause even though